Good evening, and welcome to tonight's orchestra performance. My name is Peter Curzon. You probably recognize me. I stand here and talk a lot. And tonight, I would like to introduce you to Albert Campbell, our guest organist, as well as Don Harms, our guest conductor. Take it away, Don.
Well, one night in a bar, I was... No jokes tonight. I'm thrilled to be here. We have chosen these pieces because they're some of the most prolific and important works, I would say, out there. Especially Aaron Copland, which you see, I think you have programs, right? He is one of our most famous composers today. He lived to 90 years old, so unlike Mendelssohn, who died at 38. And I think Mendelssohn actually wrote more pieces than Copland did in his 38 years, than Copland wrote in his 90 years. But of course, they're still profound, and we play them today. The one we've chosen, his first piece that we're going to play is The Fanfare for the Common Man. And most fanfares are for queens and kings, and when the army comes back, the soldiers come back. And this one is especially important because he wrote it for the common man. In fact, he was asked to write it. He wasn't for the common man. He was asked to write it for the, it was in 1942, he wrote it for the Cincinnati Symphony. The composer Eugene Goossens, I'm sure we all know him, he asked him to write some fanfares for the symphony to play before every concert. Well, Copland wrote one of them, and then he asked 17 other composers to write a fanfare. So he wanted a fanfare for every single concert. So Copland is the only fanfare of all the composers that we still play today. And he said, I think, Aaron, wouldn't it be great if we wrote it, just again, not for the kings and queens. It was during World War II when he asked him to do this. But he said, let's write it for the common man. He said, in fact, let's write it during tax season. Because there's nothing more common that everybody has to pay taxes, and kings and queens don't often have to pay taxes. So Aaron said, okay, if you're game, I'm game. So he wrote this 3.5 minute fanfare, and it's very, you'll hear it tonight, it's wonderful. That's what these stands are. People have been asking me, why do you have stands across? It's for the fanfare, and it's a wonderful, just incredible piece announcing, and again, not the kings and queens, but announcing for the common man. And he actually was inspired by a vice president, Henry Wallace. That doesn't say that actually that avocado cream is working well for you. You know Henry. Anyway, Henry Wallace, he wrote a speech for the common man. Again, you know, all of our presidents through history have tried to write things that are different than the next guy and the people before him. And he wrote it for, he said, I want to speak to just everybody, for the people. And so Aaron was most inspired by his work and wrote it for that in mind. Now, there were many suggestions of this. He had fanfare for the soldiers, for the sailors, for the freedom leaders, and since then it's been played on sports season. It's been played more than any other fanfare. He played for the Olympics, for the CBS Sports Spectacular, TV series, the Titans, Shea Stadium, when it was the last time Shea Stadium was up, it was 2008, before it was made into a new one. They played for Obama's inauguration celebration, the space and shuttle Endeavor, US Navy recruitments, it's on their advertisements. And I mean, it's one of the fanfares that we still play. So, it is one of my most favorite pieces, even though it's for brass and percussion, and I'm a string player. But you'll see why it's one of the favorites. So that's the first piece. Now the second piece we'll be playing is by Verdi. It's La Forza del Destino, which means the force of destiny. Now I play in the San Francisco Opera Orchestra, and we've played this many, many times. And I thought, you know, I should bone up on this because I've played it so many times and I'm not sure of the story. Opera never ends well. I mean, Mozart operas tend to be cheery, they're a little spoof, and somebody's dressed as a woman, they're pretending they're the husband, and they're really the wife, and it's just... But Verdi's operas are pretty serious, and they're very profound in a way. And this this, I don't know if you want to hear the story, but it's quite, it ends in death. Is that surprising? But it's a Spanish drama, and he wrote it for the first performance was in St. Petersburg in Russia in 1862. That's not necessarily important. It's just it's one of his operas that we still play today. Now, the thing about this opera, it was called the Doomed Opera. It was an opera that some tenors refused to sing. Pavarotti would never sing it because in 1962 in the Met, a famous singer, Leonard Warren, he actually was singing the famous aria in the third act. And he was singing his guts out and he fell to the floor to his death. He died on stage. They went to him and he fell forward and he was gone. So Pavarotti thought that was horrible. And then the next, of course, and it was also performed in a concert version in New Jersey. And as he was starting to sing that same aria, another singer, the lights went out. And they said, well, okay, the lights went out. But they found out there was a short across the street in the cemetery. There was a shortage of the light. I don't think there were lights in cemeteries, but I guess there are. So they have just, some people are very afraid of it. They have jinxed if they sing it. And it has really nothing to do with the story. But you can hear the beginning. There's kind of a doomsday, almost ominous beginning. The brass play this E minor chord, all in octaves. Bom, bom, bom. It's almost like a warning. And it's an E minor. The whole thing is in minor. So you can hear, you don't even have to see the singers or have the makeup and the artists. You hear what's going on. You hear the torment of the story. And Verdi was very good about that. I don't know if you want to hear the story. So how long do you have? Okay, I'll just say it quickly. It's a Spanish opera. It's very exciting because you're on the edge of your seat. Have anyone ever seen the opera? In fact, they changed the ending, and I didn't realize it, but I actually played it. They said that the San Francisco Opera in 2005 did a different ending, and I should have been paying attention. I should have looked up on the stage to see how it was a different ending. But okay, a gentleman, Alvaro, he's not very well known in the town, but he falls in love with a very well-to-do gentleman in the town. And he falls in love, but people don't like him very much. So they kind of secretly have a little love affair, and we'll call her Donna. Her father walks in on them, and he's furious. What? He starts to want to fight him. And Alvaro says, I don't want to fight. So he has a gun. He happens to have a gun in his pocket. They didn't have gun laws back then. And he drops the gun to show he wants peace. And guess what? The gun goes off and shoots the father. Only an opera. So the father dies. So, oh, she's just heartbroken. So she goes to a monastery. She just can't forgive herself. What have I done? Well, he goes away, and he's in horrible pain, so he joins the Spanish army. He said, well, I might as well just fight for my country. Well, guess who's also in the Spanish opera? Her brother, Donna's brother. And he's been trying to look for this guy to pay him back for killing his father. So he is caught in a terrible thing in the war, he's about to be killed. And Alvaro sees him and saves his life. Well, he doesn't know that that's the guy who killed his father. They become fast friends. Because, of course, they change their names. They all have different names. They join the army with different names. So they're fast friends. So they're going along. They're doing fine. And Alvaro gets wounded. And he's like, oh, no, what's going to happen? Well, Alvaro supposedly dies. So the brother, Donna's brother, goes, oh, no. Well, I'll go visit my sister in the monastery. I'm sick. I don't know what to do. Well, he doesn't die. He doesn't die. Alvaro is alive. So Alvaro goes to the monastery. I'm going to go find Donna. I mean, we might as well be together. I mean, I want my life to be a little better. Well, guess who's there? The brother. But when he was on his deathbed, Alvaro, he said, take this last package that I have. There's letters in there, but don't read them. Well, what do you do when they say don't read them? You read them. He opened them up, and they were from his sister. They're from his sister, and he realizes Alvaro is the guy that he's been wanting to kill this whole time. So there they are at the monastery, seeing the sister, and they start fighting, da 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 da. And he said, well, we were best friends, don't kill me, I don't want to fight you. Well, he stabs Alvaro, and meanwhile, runs to the sister to see if she's okay. Wait, am I getting this right? Yeah. He runs to the sister to see if she's okay. Are you guys following along or are you asleep? Okay. And sorry, the sister runs. The brother, sister runs. Thank you, Alan. Alan's going. The sister runs to see if they're okay. The brother, are you okay, brother? Are you okay? He stabs the sister in the heart. What a nice guy. So he dies. So Alvaro's like, okay, well, I don't know what to do. So guess what? He jumps over a ravine. And that's the end of the album. So apparently, the San Francisco Opera in 2007, we did a little cheerier version. Alvaro doesn't die, but he dies in the real one that Verdi wrote. Okay, now that we're all confused, but you can actually, you'll hear that just in the overture. We're just doing the overture, and you will hear most of the drama in that. Okay, moving on to something cheerier is Mendelssohn. And like I said, Mendelssohn died when he was 38. Now, he wrote so many things. I mean, some of his famous are the Scottish Symphony. He wrote many string quartets, Elijah. He wrote so many symphonies. Now, we're playing the number 10, which is one movement. Most of his symphonies are three movements. Some of his symphonies are four movements. And then there's some that are even five movements. But he wrote these between the age of 12 and 14. I mean, he was a genius. At 9 years old, he had his first performance, and he accompanied some people on the horn, and he just could do everything. He was also a painter. He couldn't write music fast enough. And he wrote it. Most of his music was very joyous, but he had quite a temper. So if he didn't get his way, he would just stamp, he would get so angry he would faint. And they'd have to put him in bed and he would sleep for 12 hours. And they think this was almost his demise, and why he died so early, because he just had these fits, he couldn't stand it. But he was so talented, I don't think he knew, you know, what to do with it. His music, after he wrote most of his wonderful pieces, they were not played. He was Jewish, so it could have been anti-Semitism, it could have been that they just changed the flavor of music, they didn't necessarily want that kind. He was on the cusp of romance and classical, romantic and classical. I think of it more as romantic, and you'll hear why when you hear the piece. But his music wasn't played, but now he is one of the most famous romantic composers of our time. So they picked it back up and realized, why haven't we been playing this all this time? So you'll just see again that with the youth, 12 to 14, I mean, most kids are learning video games today at that age, and he just wrote so much music, and I'm so thrilled that we're doing it. And it's just for strings, by the way. He wrote 11 string symphonies, just the strings, and then he wrote some bigger symphonies. So, any questions? Oh, you two guys, you're gonna talk some, aren't you? Albert, are you next?
Yes.
Thank you. Well, with that story, I have to come up with my own now. I play the pipe organ. Now, pipe organs have been around for many centuries. Actually, some of the earliest ones predate the birth of Christ. They weren't musical instruments as much as we know them, but the point is that they have been around forever. As signal instruments, as musical instruments, some of the earliest music that we have for organ was dated 1450. And it's a rather somewhat complicated music, in that if that's the first piece that we see in print, what was it like before they got to that point? It must have been an amazing sort of growth period. Obviously, most organs appear in large churches, in cathedrals, and not too many, not until this century, do they start appearing in concert halls. Now, here in Bankhead, it would be next to impossible to put a pipe organ in here. Part of what you're going to hear tonight is the low rumbling of what we call a 32-foot stop in the pedal. And it's not so much that you hear it as you feel it, because it shakes the floor. It goes down to like 16 cycles. And I don't So it's the feel. But if you were to build a pipe organ in here with the 30-foot, 2-foot stop, just the one pipe itself would have to be 32 feet tall, plus the foot to it. So it takes up way too much room, besides the fact in these days they are more than expensive. But we have another advantage, which we have sitting here on the stage, and this particular one is an Allen organ. But what's happened in the last half century is that there's been a renaissance in technical development. You know it in terms of CDs and digital recording. And all the organ companies now are doing the best thing they can in taking a digital sample of a real pipe organ. Some of them, they sample every single pipe in the organ. This could be 1,000 pipes or more. And then they put it through these speakers, and you'd be surprised. You think you're in a large church. And that's what we have for you tonight. And we go from extremely soft to hold on to your seats. And especially in the Sanson. The other interesting thing about the Sanson, I think, is that during the 19th century, a lot of organs started adding stops as imitations of orchestral instruments. And then what happens? We get the Sanson, and he turns around, and he takes the organ and makes it an orchestral instrument. It just becomes another beautiful palette of sound for him throughout this piece. One of my favorite countries to visit is the Netherlands. And one of the reasons is you can go into almost any small town and almost any small church, and there is a jewel of an organ. It may not be huge, but it could be an absolute jewel of a sound. And the piece that I'm going to play for you tonight, the Toccata, Trio, and Fugue on over Psalm 150, comes from that tradition. And in this case, Psalm 150 comes from a particular psalter in the Netherlands, where it is, it's just another hymn tune. It would be like a hymn tune to us. And this, the Toccata starts out trying to state the hymn tune, and then he goes into flights of fancy in between each phrase, just for fun. To me, it's reminiscent of going to a church where they've sung that song that day, and then the organist just goes wild afterwards, just for fun. Improvisation, as it were. But the entire, because they've sung it, and they probably know that tune very well, they don't need a lot of the tune to remind them this is what it's based on. The second movement, the trio, is very clear as to what the tune is, because we're doing it with very great contrast, using a Baroque reed stop called a ranquette, and you can't miss it. And you'll hear the whole tune that way. Then in the fugue, this is a combination. Schurman, you have the dates, I think 1904 to 1998. So he lived a long time too. But he taught at the conservatory the Royal Conservatory in The Hague, and also at the Rotterdam Conservatory. And that's where I crossed paths almost with him, through a student of his. And one of my first concerts in the Netherlands, in a small town called Zevenbergen, there's this gorgeous little organ, and this young student of Schumann gave me this piece of music and says, well, you might be interested in what my teacher's written. So I brought it home, and I've been playing it for more than a few times now. So I hope you will get the tune. The other thing is, yes, the fugue starts like a fugue, as you expect it to, and then at the end, he just can't resist, and he starts making it more of a toccata-like ending. So enjoy.
Thank you very much, Albert. And I will add just a few notes about Camille Saint-Saëns, and I like to stand when I talk, so that I can sometimes dance if I need to. Saint-Saëns was definitely a musical prodigy, as was Mendelssohn, as Don mentions. And his talent was evident from a very young age. He was able to read and write at age 2, and he was a Latin scholar by the age of 7. And he gave his first recital, his first public performance, at the age of 10 as a pianist. And for his, I believe he played one of the Mozart piano concertos, number 15, if I'm not mistaken. And for his encore, he actually requested from the audience that anyone could throw out any number of Beethoven's 32 piano sonatas, and he would play it from memory. And he offered this challenge to the audience, and somebody threw it out, and he sat down and played it exactly that way, and of course it was perfect. Everyone was absolutely amazed at this talent, and so word about his prodigy spread like wildfire. So needless to say, his future was certainly assured. He was also an organ scholar as well, and that's actually how he paid his bills throughout his life. He was born and raised in Paris, and he held a number of posts at increasingly visible cathedrals in Paris, where he was the chief organist, musician, and basically a rock star. And I say this because he was so famous for his improvisational skills on the organ that people would come to church just to hear him play. Never mind that they didn't care about church itself or any of the things that would happen inside the church. They just wanted to hear the organist, because, of course, his fame had spread far and wide. He was definitely a scholar in a lot of areas. He was actually very scientific. He published in a number of journals and was conversant with the scientists of his day. He was actually an expert in mathematics. Math and music often go together. And all of these things, you know, point to the fact that he was an incredible talent. But he also, of course, suffered a number of setbacks, as many of us do. In his case, a critical thing happened to him in 1875. He didn't marry until he was 40 years old. And when he married a young woman who was less than half of his age. And all of his friends advised him against this. His mother, with whom he was very close, said that this was the worst decision that he could have made. But he went ahead with it. They had 2 children. Things seemed to be happy for a while until both children died within 6 weeks of each other. And the first died of some kind of illness. We don't know what it was. And the second one actually fell out of their 4th-floor apartment window in Paris. And Saint-Saëns actually witnessed this. So he was definitely a changed man after that. And it was after that that he wrote some of his greatest music. It's during this time that he wrote The Carnival of the Animals. We've played that piece in the orchestra in recent years, and it's a big favorite. Everyone knows it. It's fun for children of any age, honestly. One of the great things you can do with that piece is just play it and then have anybody guess, okay, what animal is this? You have a dozen animals to choose from, a dozen pieces, and it could be any animal. He also wrote the Danse Macabre, famous piece, and that's something that many people I know love to play on Halloween for the kiddies who come by the door. But he was also a person of great irony. As a youth, when he was playing improvisationally in the church, he raised a lot of eyebrows from his contemporaries when they felt, you know, you really should be concentrating on the classics, Camille. You should be teaching Bach and Mozart, not Wagner and Mendelssohn and people who are almost contemporary with you. But later in his life, he became conservative to the point of being reactionary. And after World War I, he had actually started off with a tremendous respect for Wagner and actually used a lot of influences of Wagner in his music. But after World War I, he made a declaration in Paris that no self-conscious Parisian should ever listen to German music. Of course, is a nice, fair thing to say. And he also ran afoul with a lot of the younger composers of the day. He was famous for having a feud with Claude Debussy and did not like the music of Maurice Ravel. And in fact, both of those composers had interesting things to say. Debussy said this about Sanson: "I have a horror of sentimentality, and I cannot forget that its name is Sanson." And Ravel was also quoted as saying, "If he'd been making shell cases during the war, it might have been better for music." Yeah, ooh, that's tough. And another irony that Sanson also had was he was an avowed atheist his entire life, and yet he held the post of organist in Paris's greatest cathedral. And in addition to that, the sub-irony is that he actually wrote Samson and Delilah, his most famous opera, and Paris itself had a church separation with state law at the time that said you cannot actually stage any thematic theatric material that has biblical themes. This is against cultural rules. And of course, this is coming after the Paris Commune. You might remember from your history that this was the time, this is one of the many revolutions in France in the 19th century. And one of the thrusts of that particular revolution was to throw out all of the old guard, which of course included the church. So he had this kind of cognitive dissonance that was going on in his creative life and in his performance life, but all of this would come to fruition in the works that he produced. The Carnival of the Animals, he hated that piece. He thought it was a joke. He wrote it as a joke, and yet it wound up becoming one of his most famous pieces, if not the most famous work that he wrote. He never published it in his life. It was published after he died. And of course, everyone identifies with him on it. So we come to the Organ Symphony, and it's called the Organ Symphony not because it is a symphony of the organ, as Albert was saying. It is a standard symphony in the repertoire sense, which uses an organ as part of the orchestral palette. And this is distinguished from true organ symphonies that do exist. Charles Marie Vider was a famous exponent of those. He wrote a lot of organ music, and he wrote at least 10 that I'm aware of organ symphonies, where the only instrument is the organ, and the entire symphony is scored for all of the ranks and all of the different sounds, the colors that the organ is capable of doing. So in the Organ Symphony, it's called that because after Sanson died, he wrote 5 symphonies. Everyone would refer to number 3 as, oh yeah, that's the one with the organ, that's the Organ Symphony. And it became his most famous work, largely because of the thematic material that it has, many very beautiful themes all throughout, and also the fact that in the Maestoso, in the last movement, he basically just opens up all the stops, and like Albert said, you're gonna hear that tonight. When he plays the C major with the lowest C active, which is the 16 hertz C, 4 octaves below middle C, if you see any plaster coming down from the ceiling, make sure you duck and cover yourself. I don't think there's any plaster in here, but as is said, you don't hear this note, you feel it. And that actually lends a lot of the import of the symphony to the audience, is you hear it and you feel it and you experience it. There's a lot of interplay between the organ and the strings. There's a lot of dialogue and duality that goes on. As I mentioned, there's a lot of thematic material that comes to a fugue invention in the 4th movement. You hear a lot of arpeggiation, a lot of chromaticism. Beautiful symphony, beautiful piece of work. Could spend a lot of time talking about it, but I think I'll wrap it there. As always, there is a local connection with things. We live here in the Bay Area. There's a lot of music here in the Bay Area. Sanson actually came to San Francisco in 1915, and he actually conducted our very own San Francisco Symphony Orchestra as a guest conductor. And he did that for the Panama Pacific Exposition, which was the famous World's Fair at the time that celebrated the opening of the Panama Canal. Sanson has this to say about the Organ Symphony. He says, "I gave it everything I was able to give it. What I have here accomplished, I will never achieve again." And he wrote those words when he was in his 40s. He would live in into his 80s, but he understood that this particular piece of music was something that really took a lot from him, and he knew that this would be the major work of his career. And history has been friendly to him in that respect. It's his most performed symphony, and a lot of the thematic material that you'll hear tonight is quite familiar, and you'll say to yourself after the fourth movement, you'll say, oh yeah, that's right, I remember that part where the organ shakes the theater. I remember the experience more than the music, but it is a beautiful piece, so do enjoy the concert. And one final note, as always, no recording devices, no cameras, no flash, no nothing. And if you do have a cell phone, please turn it off and step on it at this time. Thank you for coming.